We don't have a quorum, but we're going to start the testimony. And Lauren Coleman is up from the assistant commissioner. Oh, and taking care of this.
I think.
Johnson?
I think.
Oh, we weren't ready.
Johnson was going to finish up.
Great.
Yeah, well, if they want me to finish up, I will.
And I will say we're going to try to get done at about 2:25. So, Mr. Johnson, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. We left off in my budget on page 6, and I believe that my budget is the third blue sheet. So you go to your third blue sheet and then find page 6. It's titled ARRA TANF Emergency Fund. Find a page that says that. Mr. Chair, this is a revenue page. You'll recall that last year in the Federal Stimulus Act, there was an opportunity for states to claim additional TANF funding, essentially to claim 80% federal reimbursement on increases we had in several areas within our TANF programs. One of those areas, and we did take advantage of all three of those areas last year in the legislative session. One of those areas was short-term non-recurring assistance. And in the interim, since the legislature met, the federal government has determined that refundable tax credits can be considered short-term non-recurring assistance under TANF. So if the state has refundable tax credits, and we've seen an increase or a growth in that, that we can claim 80% reimbursement on whatever that growth has been from the base year in the TANF emergency assistance law. Minnesota has two refundable tax credits, the working family credit and the K-12 education tax credit. We have had growth, and so we're able to actually claim federal reimbursement through TANF on the growth in those two programs, and the amount, as you see on this page, of $28 million. So this proposal is to leverage that authority to claim $28 million in TANF revenue from the federal government. And in a subsequent page, we're proposing to refinance this TANF to create general fund savings to help with the budget deficit. Mr. Chair, the next page, page 8, is the TANF refinancing page. Refinancing of TANF is something that we do with the federal TANF money when we have it available, either through what I just mentioned, for example, or through program reductions which create TANF savings. We refinance it to create general fund savings so we can take the savings in the general fund rather than in the TANF fund. This page proposes to refinance TANF from four sources. First, yesterday I talked about the reduction in the MFIP program by counting SSI income. That resulted in about $21 million in savings in TANF in this biennium and about $60 million in the out years. There's a basic sliding fee underspending of $5 million in TANF that we're proposing to take. I did not mention that here. That's under the Early Childhood Committee's jurisdiction. The working family credit claim of $28 million, which I just talked about. And then the fourth area is when Ms. Rankin talked about our administrative reductions yesterday, she mentioned a small amount of those reductions are coming in TANF as well. All of those TANF sources are accumulated here, proposed to be refinanced to create savings for the general fund of about $55 million in 10 and 11 and about $64 million in 12 and 13.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, can you tell us kind of what are the demographic characteristics or what is the population who receive SSI? Who do they typically look like?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hosh, many SSI recipients are the elderly. Most of them that we talk about in the context of the MFIP program and individuals who would be on an MFIP family or receiving SSI, both children and parents, about two-thirds parents and about a third are children. They're people with disabilities, certified as having a disability by the Social Security Administration. In some cases, they may be grandparents who are caring for children, not necessarily the parents of the children, but generally speaking, they are people with disabilities.
Federal approval to analyze SSI recipients in this way?
Mr. Chair, we have been working with the Social Security Administration around this proposal, and they have said that we can do this at least tentatively. We're looking at a couple of other issues that have been raised within the last 24 hours to see if there are other issues there. But as of right now, we believe we can under our discussions with the Social Security Administration.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been talking about this, Mr. Johnson, in early childhood. So for SSI, as to that question, are any of those people working or have an outside income outside of the SSI income, or is it their primary income?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawik, it's definitely their primary income. For the most part, folks don't work. I think there are a few that do work under special programs, but generally speaking, SSI is provided to people who are determined not able to work.
Continue, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the next two pages in your book are under the jurisdiction of the Early Childhood Committee, so I'm skipping to page 12. Mr. Chair, this page has two separate proposals on it, both of which are related to fees. I'll speak to the first one and have Ms. Castellano from Healthcare speak to the second. The first proposal on this page relates to electronic benefit transfer, which is the manner in which we provide benefits for cash and food to individuals who are on our cash and food programs. This refers particularly to the food support program, what is called federally now the SNAP program. The electronic benefit is essentially a card that we give to folks that is loaded with their benefits. They can take it to a point-of-sale terminal in a grocery store, swipe it to pay for their groceries. It's programmed to only allow them to purchase food with the food dollars that they have available to them. This was something we started doing around 1998 when that was established. There was also established a 4-cent reimbursement to grocers, retailers, for each transaction that went through on their equipment at the grocery store. This was reflected, I think, an initial concern by retailers that there were going to be added costs to having to manage these cards and this new way of doing business, and the retailers concerned they wanted to have some offset to that. We don't believe that this fee we're paying to retailers make any sense in the current environment where many and almost all grocery stores have their own card equipment, because most all of us swipe a card when we go to the grocery store. That's built into how they do business. It's part of how the business model now works in retail. This is particularly an issue for us now because the costs are going up dramatically in this retailer fee that we pay over the last year or so. First of all, as I mentioned yesterday, the food stamp caseload has increased appreciably, over 30% in the last year. That means more people are getting food assistance, more transactions happening, more reimbursement that we're making to retailers. Secondly, we have had large retailers coming onto the system within the last year, which has really pushed our costs up quite a bit higher. We have been bumping around over the last several years at around $10,000 a month in how much we are paying in retailer fees. We're now over $30,000 a month in what we're paying in retailer fees. This is a concern for us given the administrative reductions we've taken, the other pressures we have in order to deal with the growing caseloads in terms of sending notices and postage costs and mailing and so forth. We thought this was one that we could fix relatively easily. Many states had this retailer fee in place when EBT was first put in place. There are now only four left, ourselves and three other states. We believe that it's time for Minnesota to move as well. We're proposing only to suspend the fee for a year and then to study it and see if there are any impacts in terms of access for clients or on retailers, and then come back with a recommendation as to whether or not we should continue or we should get rid of the fee permanently or put it back in place. And I'll ask Ms. Castellano to talk to the second piece on the page.
So the second piece on the page that you see is related to the rate that DHS pays for the Vaccine for Children's program. This is the
Could you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Susan Castellano, Department of Human Services, Healthcare Administration. The VFC program pays for vaccines. The feds essentially send us vaccines that are administered free of charge to children on the Medicaid program. And the rate that's in the statute that Medicaid pays for providers for that administration is $8.50. Any other vaccine that a provider administers pays at only $1.50. So when the H1N1 vaccine came through this year that the feds were providing free, because it was not a VFC vaccine, it only paid providers the $1.50 for administration, not the $8.50 for administration, and there was concern from our colleagues at the health department that was not sufficient reimbursement and we would not see enough providers take up the administration of the H1N1 vaccine. And so this essentially just changes that 850 to apply to all federally supplied vaccines, including anything that may come through around, you know, emergency preparedness or other kinds of issues.
And what's the total cost of that then?
Total cost, the state share is about $87,000.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 14. This page deals with two small eliminations within the Child Support Enforcement Program. The first relates to the medical provider bonus. We have been, for a decade or so, when we started to work harder trying to do a better job of establishing paternity within the child support program. Paternity is very important. It starts the child support process, identifying who the father is for the purpose of enforcing child support. In order to do a better job of establishing paternity, we created a program working with the hospitals to have the hospitals work on voluntary recognition of parentage, usually at the time a child is born. It's a very good time to catch both parents involved with the child and to get a voluntary recognition of the father at that point in order to establish the baseline for child support enforcement. We also established this $300,000 fund to pay a bonus to each recognition of parentage that a hospital provided of $25. We have been doing that now for several years. It has now been several years, however, that we exceed the federal standard for our paternity establishment. We believe that we have a good process in place working with the hospitals now for getting paternity established. We don't believe we need to have this funding in place anymore. The funding has not been enough to cover the $25 over the last several years. We've been prorating it already. So we're proposing to eliminate the fee at this time. Mr. Chair, the second piece that's on this page, which is separate, is $100,000 of revenue to the general fund. In 2004, the University of Minnesota created a pilot project around healthy marriage and responsible fatherhood. They were funded through the federal government through the Office of Child Support Enforcement, so that money flowed through the Child Support Enforcement Division at DHS. The university needed to have a state match to that. They came to the legislature. That what was done at that time is a $5 was added on to the marriage license, and that $5 was dedicated to this project. The project is now over, but the $5 is still dedicated and still flowing to the Department of Human Services. We're proposing to take that dedicated revenue, undedicate it, basically send it back to the general fund in the amount of $100,000 of benefit to the general fund.
So, Mr. Johnson, this is a fee that hospitals were getting but will not get in the future?
Mr. Chair, for the first piece of this, that's correct. That $300,000 is a fee, a reimbursement the hospitals get now that they would not get under this proposal.
Mr. Chair. And the $5 fee on the marriage license will continue on, but it won't be used for what it was used for before.
Mr. Chair, that's correct under this proposal.
Representative Scalzi.
In line with that same, thank you, Mr. Chair. By discontinuing the $25 fee for the recognition of parentage, then do we lose some federal incentive funds? And then what would incent the hospitals to do that for us, which is a service to the state, if we can recognize who the parents are and not have the state be the parent in the long run?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we don't lose federal incentive money. We don't believe we will because we're performing well above the federal standard for our paternity establishment. We believe the hospitals will continue doing this because it's now built into their processes and our processes. I think that there's a chance that some hospitals may not be happy with losing the $25. It's not a real significant form of revenue to them, but certainly it is some revenue.
Continue.
Mr. Chair, page 15 in your books. This proposal is to eliminate the Minnesota Food Assistance Program, or MFAP. MFAP was started in 1998. You'll recall that in the mid to late 90s, the federal government made some changes to the food stamp program such that some legal non-citizens were made ineligible for the federal food stamp program. Minnesota and a number of states created state programs to help fund food support for those individuals. Minnesota did that in 1998. In 2003, that program was limited to only those who were over the age of 50. But basically, this program mirrors the federal, what used to be called the food stamp program, is now called Supplemental Nutritional Assistance. Same rules, same benefits. We just administer kind of as a shadow program. So it's administered like an entitlement program, but it's funded with a fixed appropriation. And as we know, that sometimes creates problems, and this last year has. With the increase in the food support program, we've also seen an increase in the MFAT program. Usually had around 200 people using this program in a given month. Now we're up to about 250. Also, when the federal government did the stimulus around food stamps, they increased benefits by 13.6%. We mirrored that for the MFAP and passed through that kind of a benefit increase. As a result of this, we're short of the funding for the program. In 2010, we're about $132,000 short. We have some money in that appropriation that we can transfer over to cover for the rest of this fiscal year. But in 2011, we project that we will be short by $200,000 in the need of money to fund this program. So we're recommending to eliminate it. If you don't want to eliminate, propose to do something else, you need to be aware that we need another $200,000 next year to meet the need as the program is currently defined in law.
Continue, please.
Mr. Chair, the next...
Before that, I just want to make sure. So these are our legal residents.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. They are legal non-citizens. They're lawfully permanent residents. Mr. Chair, on page 16, this page has a reduction to one grant and elimination of another. The first is a one-time $1.3 million reduction in the MFIP-supported work appropriation. You'll recall that over the last several years, we've appropriated funds to help with supported work and subsidized work within the MFIP program. These dollars have been used by counties to create transitional jobs, help with our work participation rate, certainly helpful in the current economy. We believe that we can reduce that funding in 2011 by $1.3 million and still have as much available as the counties have this year. It's a little bit complicated because there's carry forward on these dollars. The county spending pattern is a little bit unclear. And we're also, on the same time that we're doing this activity, we're earning some of the federal stimulus TANF dollars, and those dollars are dedicated back to the same function. So we're also earning those dollars, which will help to buffer us in the next several years in terms of how much money we'll have available for this function. So we're proposing here to make a reduction of $1.3 million in 2011. We believe that will still allow the counties to have enough money to continue the programs they have in place now, and over time, hopefully continue this for a couple more years. Mr. Chair, the second piece on this page is the elimination of a grant which is appropriated in the Group Residential Housing Program. It's a special dedicated grant to a program that serves a homeless population with serious mental illness. This is the People Inc. program in Minneapolis. The reduction is proposed here is to eliminate that grant. People Inc. does receive GRH and supplemental payments under GRH. This is an extra grant that's on top of that of $460,000.
So the People Inc. would be getting $460,000 less than that one facility?
Mr. Chair, it's a reduction, it's elimination of the grant they get, which is $460,000 that's on top of the regular GRH payments.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, could you tell us what the magnitude of the regular payments is to this group? So I get a sense of the proportion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I don't have that information. I don't know if someone here does.
I can get it afterwards.
Is that fine? We can get it to you later? Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 17. this is a technical page. There were some errors made in riders last year. Some of those were in base level for 12 and 13. You can see the adjustments in aligning the riders with the intent. There was also a mistake made in the TANF rider last year. We sent a letter to the chair and to Senator Berglund about this because we had to implement it in the way that made sense. And so this is correcting and aligning it with the way we actually implemented the TANF refinancing last year. And Mr. Chair, page 18, this is a page of special revenue reductions. Ms. Rankin mentioned yesterday that in our reductions, we looked into every fund, including special revenue funds for reductions. These are special revenue funds in the child support area and in the child welfare area. We are going to put all the special revenue proposals together within the department and figure out the best way to balance and hit these targets. So I don't have specifics what the impacts will be, but generally speaking, it's in the child welfare area of training, adoptions, and the Children's Trust Fund. In the child support area, it's in supports we provide to counties.
Questions for Mr. Johnson? Don't see any, so that
Mr.
was the last
Chair,
page, right?
Mr. Chair, that's the end of my part of the presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
And now we get Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner at Department of Human Services for Continuing Care. It's good to see you all again. You can continue on, I believe, from where Mr. Johnson left off to the next blue page, which shows the continuing care proposals. But before we review those pages, the specific proposals, we were asked to address the growth in our programs. And so let me talk about that first. You've been provided a one-page summary from the department based upon the November forecast, and just for everybody's reference, I think you were provided that previously. The top of the page shows the long-term care programs and the history as well as the projected growth over the next couple years. And you can see from 2006 to 2011 fiscal years, the growth in the total long-term care programs is just slightly over 6%. But as you may recall, last year we came before you with some significant long-term care reform proposals that much of which did get enacted into law. Much of the impact from that, though, won't be evident during this period of time and really takes hold because we're in the process of implementing those decisions. We really start seeing the effect of those decisions in 12, 13, and beyond. So if you recalculate what is projected for the couple years following this chart, the actual growth in the long-term care programs for Minnesota is just slightly over 5%. And recall that without those reforms, the growth in our programs would have been in excess of 8% annually. Getting a little more specific, if we look at the programs, long-term care programs for the elderly, we project over the next number of years that the growth in our elderly programs will be about 2% annually with the impact of the reforms that were passed last year. And most of that is in the certainly the home and community-based side. The growth in the institutional side actually goes down slightly. So that's where we've tried to focus our attention, and within the programs for people over the age of 65. There is modest growth in persons who will be eligible for these programs. So the 2% really represents either increased acuity or some modest increased rates that are reflected with higher need individuals in the elderly programs.
Not today, but if you could get us the number of people in each one of those programs, that would be interesting. Because, you know, the whole idea of the waivers is to keep people out of nursing homes.
Correct. I'll get you some graphs on that. I'll give you some preliminary information that I have in front of me. If you look at the programs for the elderly in 2009, long-term care facilities will have about 17,600. It's actually projected to decline through 2013 to 16,100. So we'll serve fewer people on a monthly basis. Now, let me clarify that, in that actually we serve more people in facilities, but they're shorter stay, and so they come and they leave. But the actual monthly census in facilities is actually declining. On the waivers in home care for the over 65 population, there will be some modest growth. In 2009, about 27,000 individuals monthly. In 2013, a little over 29,000. But again, we'll get you the precise graphs on the people served in these programs. Turning to the under 65 population, the programs for people with disabilities, we have a slightly different cost curve. If we look at those, we are projecting that the annual increase in expenditures is right around 7% from 2009 through 2013. And that is driven primarily by increased individuals, higher caseload. It's almost all in the home and community-based programs. We have very few individuals who are utilizing the institutional side of programs for people with disabilities, and that is declining also during this same time frame. So currently, or 2009, we had approximately 3,000 people under the age of 65 using long-term care facilities. That is projected to decline to about 2,700 over this 2009 to 2013 period. The individuals on waivers and home care in 2009 was about 42,000 individuals, and that is projected to increase to a little over 52,000 individuals according to current law. So that's where the 7% growth factor is most applicable. I will note that we currently, and you'll see, we'll talk about enrollment restrictions for the disability waivers. I will note that those enrollment limits that are currently in law do not apply to the last couple of years of this time frame that I'm talking about. That's a decision that may or may not be continued in subsequent biennial budgets. So that's where that growth factor comes in, because those don't exist currently. We have to recognize that according to current law what the projection would be. So that's kind of the growth story on long-term care services in Minnesota.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a couple of questions about this as I'm trying to understand the way you've presented the figures here. First of all, last time we discussed this, I don't know if it was you or somebody else, but said that I'm talking about the portion D on the page here, that a third of it was enrollment increases and two-thirds of it was cost and utilization. And I thought I heard you just say that it was mainly enrollment increase. So that's one question that I have. And then the second is more maybe a comment, and that is that the way you've presented this with annual percent change, you know, Well, obviously, most of the world thinks about annual change, but we think in two-year increments around here. And that's usually the way people talk to us about our budget growth. And so I just want to say that I guess we've got to just, you know, add them together here. If you're talking about a 7.19% change, average annual change, the average biennial, I assume, is twice that, 14.4%. Right? Is that, well, am I looking at this correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, let me redirect you to the column above that. You're looking at medical care. You're looking at basic care. I'm focused on long-term care, which is box AB and AB total.
Okay.
So first I want to redirect you there. I would agree with you that the forces kind of make us look at two-year segments. We approach this, or we try to approach this, from a longer-range perspective, and that's what the reform ideas that we brought forward last year were attempting to achieve, is to slow this growth, to change those numbers from 7, 8, 9, 10% to something less than that by changing the way we provide long-term care services to Minnesotans. I'm not clear I understand why the math would double, or what, you know, how that, as you're expressing that, why the numbers would be greater than what's represented here. So I'm not sure from a statistic standpoint what you're suggesting.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not questioning what you have on the page. It's just that when we talk about our budget increase, and we set a two-year budget.
Right.
So when we look at cost drivers in our budget, we have to kind of, it's practically, I suppose it's the same, but I guess I'm asking, you know, in terms of a two-year budget, I suppose we ought to be adding together the two of the annual percentages here, right? I mean, it doesn't look so, you know, to say, well, we had 6% growth. I mean, that's pretty bad when our revenues are shrinking, but it's not a horrible, out of control thing. But if you add two together, then you're...
Mr. Chair,
that's usually
now,
how it's presented.
Thanks for the clarification. Yes, on a biennial basis, you would have to look at the total effect of both years to look at the growth in expenditures for the two-year cycle. You know, they're all of the numbers are large, and so every percentage point has impact. And so whether 4% or 5% or 6% is considered large or not, when you multiply it against the total expenditures, it does have impact. But again, and I may say this more times today, that's why we tried to take a longer range view to how to sustain our programs, how to look at who we are offering services to, what services we're offering to those individuals, and to try to incent lower cost ways of helping people remain independent.
Well, I would just say those are big numbers. That's that column, A plus B total, that's three as in billion. Representative Bunn.
Yes, it was taken care of.
Okay, with that, if we want to turn to the proposals, page one of the continuing care section recommends a 2.5% rate reduction for home and community-based waiver programs, home care services such as personal care, as well as nursing facilities, ICFs, MR, and continuing care grants effective July 1, 2010. This is not a new topic. It's not a new proposal. As we've been going through deficit years, this is one of the ways that has been used to slow the growth in our programs by reducing the rates we pay for those services. When we're proposing rate reductions, or when others are proposing rate reductions, we're often asked, what will be the result of this rate cut? And that's a very difficult question to answer. We have 4,500 providers in our long-term care system in Minnesota, and we've got tens of thousands of consumers who are in those programs. And as indicated earlier, it's a multi-billion dollar expenditure. We're required by federal law to assure that there continues to be reasonable access to Medicaid programs. And it is our judgment that following multiple years of reductions as well as changes that we're making to our long-term care system, that we need to do a better job of monitoring, studying, and assuring access to those programs. And so, therefore, you will see in this proposal a request for some dollars to initiate a more specific analysis of what are these changes doing to the long-term care programs, what are the rate changes, having what kind of impact they are having upon access to programs by our consumers, as well as the impact to the providers, the 4,500 providers. So there is an FTE as well as some contract dollars in here so that we can study, assess, and report back more assuredly what the impact of these multiple years are having.
Why is the GAMC proposal in here, since that's not continuing care?
Mr. Chair, that's a zero line, so I don't. It's not recognized as part of this specific proposal.
Okay. Okay. Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, on the rate changes history, on the page 2, at the continuing care grants side of thing, so that is a reduction next fiscal year of really of almost 9%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that was specific to some continuing grants, the 8.83%. That was not across all long-term care programs.
But what is it?
Those were grants that provided services, for example, to deaf and hard of hearing individuals and other populations that were not part of the specific waivers.
Okay, can we, Mr. Chair, can we just get a list of what all those grants were?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we'll do that.
Oh, that would have been in the unallotment stuff we would have gotten earlier.
Correct.
Okay, we probably had that then. But that would be good to get the list.
Yeah. Continue, please.
Okay, the page 3, the recommendation is that we continue the waiver, the disability waiver growth limits for 1 year additional and make them deeper or more restrictive.
I'm sorry, can we just go back to the last one? So you're now going to hire an FTE for the first time to monitor and evaluate access to MA services? You haven't been doing that before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we've been doing it on an anecdotal basis. We can track some information, but we really don't have a systematic way of knowing throughout the state of Minnesota what the access to services are. And we are concerned with multiple reductions what the access to services will be in the future.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, I just have to say, it's hard for me to believe we haven't been doing that It seems like a basic function of the agency, and I don't know why we would give them another FTE to do something they probably ought to be doing already. And this is going to, I'm assuming, going to be coming up over and over again in this budget, but it just, you know, when we're cutting services that actually can go to people, you know, to be hiring more people, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we had this same exact request in the last round, and I questioned it then. Why would we need another FTE if we're cutting services? So did we add that FTE, and now this would be an additional FTE to the one that we just added in the last go-round?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did receive some resources to implement the reform packages, the long-term care reform package ideas that we presented last year. This is an additional request to, again, more systematically evaluate the access to services question.
Wow.
Let me just ask on the disability waiver growth limits. To be eligible for the waiver, you have to be eligible to be in a facility.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So if we don't do the waivers, are we really saving money, or are these people just going to go into a nursing home?
Mr. Chair, there will be some impact upon facility utilization, and that is represented on the page. It still results in a savings. But we do recognize that there will be some individuals who, if they cannot access the disability waivers, may need institutional care.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just as a follow-up to that, why is that not more correlated one-to-one? I mean, where's the drop-off? Where's the fall-off between those two? If you're to be eligible for one, you have to be eligible for the other. I'm just wondering where the drop-off goes.
Mr. Cool. Chair, Representative, some people may choose not to enter an institution and will use other services that are available to them as a different way of remaining independent. They still will have access to PCA services, home care services, family support grants, consumer support grants. So the waiver is not the only way that people can receive services, but their needs may be great enough that if they're not able to access the waiver and that level of funding, that they will need to move to an institution.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got two questions now from that response. Mr. Coleman, do waivers pay for things like PCA services and home care services and the very functions you just mentioned?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, yes, you can access PCA services through the waivers.
So, Mr. Coleman, if somebody were to lose waiver services, they could lose those other supporting services you mentioned.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, that's not necessarily the case. Although people typically don't lose a waiver service through this limitation, once you have what's known as a waiver slot, you're in the waiver program, and we can't change that. Now, the reforms from last year where we're changing the level of care may have an impact upon some people who will no longer qualify for either nursing facility level of care or waivers. But this proposal does not have that impact.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Coleman, I am wondering if the department had contemplated just eliminating, for instance, waivers altogether as a way to balance the budget, rather than we seem to continue to get proposals back from the department that shave a little bit off of everything, and it's like watching everything sort of loses effectiveness. So I'm wondering, as you work through the budget proposal, if you looked at the cumulative effect of the little bits of cuts here and the little bits of cuts there on the impact of the people being served, and if you made a contemplative decision about the shaves rather than just saying we're going to put the scarce resources we have into making sure there's basic services like PCA services, et cetera, for the population being served.
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly we've considered that, but I think that to eliminate the program would have a very dramatic effect upon thousands of people. The state has made a conscious decision to provide home and community-based services to people with disabilities and to not rely upon institutions. So number one, we don't have the institutions to provide services to people any longer because many of them have been eliminated throughout the state. And we still value the waivers substantially. What we have tried to do is be more targeted. And again, I'll reference last year where we've tried to target the waivers and nursing facility care to those that have the greatest needs. Because we recognize that they still have those needs. And to try to incent other lower cost ways to deal with the growing demand for services. Essential community support, the use of technology, consumer-directed models that we're working on to implement. So, sure, we consider elimination, but after kind of analyzing the total impact, we think that that would be very dramatic for the people that we're serving.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, if the decisions that we're making are going to lead or likely will lead to the need to consider institutionalization for some of the people who are going to lose services, and as you say, we don't really have those institutions available anymore. What will happen to those people?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we still have some capacity in the institutional section or sector of the programs. We would not have enough if we eliminated the waivers, was what I was representing, because there are tens of thousands of individuals on the waivers.
Mr. Chair. Just one more. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, is the care in the institution more expensive?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, on the average, the care in the institution is more expensive. Not for each individual, but on average, institutional care is more expensive.
Representative Thiessen.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Coleman.
Okay, moving to page 5. The next proposal is to separate the elderly waiver case mix caps from the nursing facility operating rate increases. When the elderly waiver was originated many years ago, kind of the standard that was used was let's pay for services outside of an institution so long as it doesn't exceed a facility cost. And so that limit was put in place. And currently what we're able to spend on an individual on the elderly waiver based upon their case mix is limited to that amount. The elderly waiver has grown, and we're serving more and more people in the community who are over the age of 65. And this proposal recognizes that we want to make decisions somewhat independent. We want to manage the elderly waiver, allow the legislature to manage the elderly waiver on the basis of how much money we want to allocate to that and not let it rise or fall based upon nursing facility cost. Nursing facility cost, because of the way the system is evolving, is caring for people with higher needs. And it's not the same complement of consumers that that fed this kind of process 10, 15 years ago. So we want a purposeful decision about elderly waiver that doesn't create an automatic increase to what we're able to spend on those individuals. So this delinks that decision that if nursing home rates go up for whatever reason or fall down for whatever reason, that elderly waiver goes along with that. It would be a separate decision based upon the elderly waiver program.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you come up with the numbers for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the impact is, as you can see by the chart, something into the future, and that's based upon current law. Whatever current law allows for increases in nursing facility rates, that would increase. If we de-link that, then there's a savings.
And, Mr. Chair, so the savings assumes no increase, or is it related to this home and community-based services increases?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the page assumes that there would not be an increase in elderly waiver rates unless a decision was made by the legislature.
And Mr. Chair, is this also reflecting a decrease in home and community-based rates? I mean, didn't we do something about that on an earlier page, or is that different?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's an interaction here, but this is specific to what would happen to the case mix rates under elderly waiver and related to the nursing facility rate component.
Okay, and I guess, and maybe I don't know enough about this, but so would the, if we make reductions in rates on the home and community-based side, is that going to, is this going to also go down?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, you're challenging my logic on this. The rates on the elderly waiver will go down if the 2.5% rate decrease occurs to those programs. This is independent of that. It's part of home and community-based services. The elderly waiver is part of home and community-based services. And somebody's coming to my rescue.
There's a line in the provider rate reduction page that accounts for interactions.
Okay. Thank you. The line there is a line. If we go back to page one, there is a line right in the middle of the page that accounts for an interactive effect. MA long-term care waivers and home care, and it shows a slight cost.
Okay.
Apparently, that's how the accounting is accommodated with the interaction of these of this proposal.
And Mr. Coleman, if we say reduce the PCA people or treatment in the elderly waiver, that would be unrelated. Well, you're going to de-link it, so I mean, you don't get PCAs in a nursing home.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So if we eliminated or reduced the amount of hours that you can have in the waiver for a PCA, that would just affect the one side, not the other.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this proposal is really trying to address the cap, the maximum amount that we're allowed to recognize for an individual. Doesn't mean that everyone is at the cap, but it does reduce the cap.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Representative Broad.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand this as well. So the savings that are you're showing on page 5 are actual savings because of the reduction in the governor's budget related to the rates, the 2.5% rates, or are these savings only savings because of the delinking of the two?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is the delinking portion.
So then, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coleman, then where is the savings? Say you didn't delink. Where are the savings then in the budget for the reduction? Do you know what I'm asking?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, the savings for the reduction are on page 1.
They're both
the 2.5% savings that apply against all the waiver rate reductions would be represented on page one.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Coleman, then the savings are additive. So you're saving on both sides.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Coleman. If both of these proposals were accepted, then there would be the savings, yes.
But Mr. Chair?
No, Representative Thiessen.
But it looks like it's actually costing us money in that interaction. On page one.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, there still is a net savings, though.
No, I understand that. Oh,
to this proposal.
We don't need to spend so much time on this right now, but it's... And I also think it has to do with, because I don't really understand the caps. And so we should probably just spend more time talking about that.
We'd be happy
at another
to do so.
Time.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Coleman.
Okay, page six. This is a proposal that we've utilized before. We've done this shift in the past. We have a balance in the rebate budget for the HIV program currently, and so we're recommending that we shift $2 million from the state grant to capture that short-term surplus in the drug rebate account, and that we would return that money, as we've done in the past, in a subsequent year. So this is simply a shift. We've got the drug rebate money in order to pay for insurance, case management, et cetera, in a different account. We will need this money in the future based upon current projections of services to people with HIV in subsequent years because it's a growing population.
So this... The combination of those would mean there was no reduction in services.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Okay, moving to page eight. The recommendation on this page is to phase out nursing facility rate equalization over several years. Rate equalization prohibits nursing facilities from charging private paying individuals a rate greater than what medical assistants will pay, except for those individuals who are in single rooms. We would gradually phase it out. It's a it's a way to allow for some additional flexibility for nursing facilities. And on July 1, 2010, facilities would be allowed to charge a 2% differential to private paying individuals. An additional 2% would be allowed on 10-1-11, an additional 2% on 10-1-12, and then when we get to 10-1-13, facilities would be allowed to charge private paying individuals whatever the market would allow. I'm sure that this will generate a considerable amount of discussion. This is a long-standing practice in Minnesota, and it is a recommendation to phase it out, to monitor it, and make sure that we know what's going on in the marketplace. Mr. Chair.
So if you were a private pay person in a nursing home, and we reduce the rate to providers in our nursing homes 2.5%, that reduction would not show up in the private pay. In fact, he would get a 2% increase over what he's currently paying, or does that, how does that relate to the private pay versus what we're doing to the public pay?
Right. Mr. Chair, there's a combination there. If the rate is reduced or increased, for that matter, to nursing facilities, whatever the Medicaid rate is at that time would be the barometer, so to speak, and you would be able to charge 2% greater than that. So I guess if the decision was to reduce 2.5%, then facilities would be allowed to move 2% higher than the new rate would be. Okay. Yep. So it'd almost be a wash in that case.
And how does this relate to the surcharge put on the private pay people?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there's a relationship between that. The surcharge is not being proposed to be changed. So the private paying individuals would still be paying that portion of the rate.
Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I read some material on this, and my understanding, though, was that when we did away with the rate equalization, the main thing is that there may be some extra services that a facility would like to offer. Right now, they can't do that because everything has to be exactly the same. There are some private pay patients that may wish to have some additional services, and right now, they can't even get those additional services, even if they're willing to pay for them. But my understanding from what I read, it also had to do with that this would allow for providing some additional services that would help them to gain some additional revenue. Is this part of the discussion, or is what I read not correct? Or faulty memory?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware that we're changing the elements of what is allowed to be provided from a discrimination standpoint. I don't believe that's part. Will you, Mr. Held, please?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Bob Held from the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, under current law, a facility is permitted to offer special services. The facility has to offer them to all people in all parts of the facility and has to offer them to everybody at the same rate. But if the facility wants to offer deluxe towels, newspapers, televisions, telephone service, whatever you want to do, it can't be something that they have to already be providing to be licensed. It can't be something that's already included in the rate. But if they make it available to anybody, then they can do that today. And this does not change that.
So the MA, the person on MA in the nursing home, if his family wanted to pay that extra fee, they could do that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer, you got another?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think that kind of clarifies it. And so, but what I'm looking at here, though, is more a matter of if you can charge different rates to private pay than you do to medical assistance, I look at this in the future as it might be a real easy thing for us to just keep dropping the medical assistance rate, figuring the private would just make up the difference. But on the other hand, I'm hearing this being done in other states, so there must be some other information to balance this concept out because other states have done this.
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have a responsibility to make to ensure that people on medical assistance have access to nursing facilities, but there's no requirement that facilities participate in the Medicaid program. So if the rates were to drop to a level by which they could no longer sustain themselves as a business, we may see that occur, but we've not seen facilities drop from participating in medical assistance.
Okay, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick questions. Mr. Coleman, how many states have equalization right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're one of two states that have equalization.
Okay. And then real quickly, just to kind of get an idea who this would benefit more than others, what's the payer mix of Minnesota, you know, private pay versus MA?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Mr. Held can answer that detail.
All I have are details. Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, MA is about 59% of resident days, and private pay is about 25%.
I might be off. That might be 27, but it's in that range.
Correct.
Yeah. About 9%, Mr. Chair, about 9% of days are Medicare, and the balance is what we categorize as other. And that could be Veterans Administration or managed care.
And do we have any limit on the amount they can charge for a single room versus the MA rate?
Mr. Chair, there's a complexity in that called the single bed election, but that's a choice that the facility makes, and depending on how they make that choice, they could be limited to 10%, but if they elect the other way, then there is no limitation on what the private pay charge could be today in a single bedroom.
Representative Hodge. One last question. Are there areas of the state that have higher concentrations of private pay versus other areas of the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, we'd have to get back to you on that. I don't know.
I'd like that. I think there's other ideas that we can do on equalization and rate reductions to try to level things out, because some homes are going to have very little private pay and they're going to be hit much harder without an ability to recoup, while others that have high private pay, you know, they could be relatively unharmed or minimized greatly. So.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think as visiting many nursing homes in the past years, one of the things that I've seen increasingly is they're moving to single beds for everybody, especially for seniors. They sleep better. There's many care reasons and also other things that are increasingly. So I think the single bed is something that the needs in the market are already making a change to. I don't know if that has as much of an effect, especially when you realize that the majority aren't private pay anyway. But I think more of the issues are, if we're only one of two states, Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested in knowing how this might have affected other states. And if we're only one of two, there must be some other dynamic that there must be some statistics out there to show that this may be just fine.
Okay, next is Representative Rood. Then we have Hayden, Gottwald, and Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh asked my questions.
Okay, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of my questions have been answered to this point, too. I just have maybe two questions. One is your explanation about the faster spin down. You laid out that over time it kind of follows what you predict inflation would be, and therefore the spin down rate wouldn't be, I mean, it would be equal. Could you say a little more about that? And that's why you don't see an increase in the MA rolls because of this provision.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have any history here. This has never been done before. We've never had equalization and then taken it off because of being one of only two states that ever applied equalization. And so it's hard to predict how many facilities will choose to charge a differential. Additionally, there are many options for individuals now, private paying, as well as people on our public programs. There are many more options now than there were when this provision was passed many years ago. And so the marketplace is going to influence what people are already spending their money on, as well as one of our greater strategies has been consumer education. Trying to provide information for consumers, elderly, as well as their adult children, to make informed decisions. That's what Linkage Lines and the Minnesota Nursing Home Report Card, Minnesota Help, all of those are trying to provide good consumer information. People are already choosing based upon cost and location and service, whether they want to go into a nursing facility, an assisted living facility, stay at home. And so it's really hard to predict with great accuracy how much of a differential will occur. It's one of the additional reasons why we're phasing it out so that we can monitor over the next 3 years how many facilities are going to choose to increase their price based upon this new statute.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Holman. I know some folks that work in your ombudsman office, and I know that they're really, really busy all across the state, kind of dealing with not only issues of care, but all of those issues. So I think that, as you know, though we do have a lot of services out there, seniors are one of our most vulnerable populations, especially as it relates to consumer choices. So that being said, I have a bill to add more ombudsmen, so I hope I can get some support as we enter. As we push this forward. At any rate, my last question or statement is that, and it kind of really follows Representative Hosh's, I think, where he was going, which is similar to our debate that we've had, quite frankly, with Representative Murphy's GAMC debate, which is that there are parts of this state that disproportionately have people who don't have the money to private pay. And so to that end, I could see in the long term that we end up with a very same scenario, similar situation, that people that are low income end up going to certain parts of the state in order to live, in this case, like we are when they go to get services for hospitals, and people in other parts of the state that are a little more wealthy, and that can pay the increased cost, end up living there. And so I think one of the unintended effects, or if I may say, as we phase out equalization, is that we create the same dynamic that we have with our vulnerable and poor population in terms of who's getting medical care and where they're getting their medical care versus not. So I just think that's something for us to at least understand and take a look at. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to pass, but I think it's important we understand this, too. Rate equalization is something nursing homes want right now. It doesn't mean that people who need help are not going to get it, and at an equal basis across the state. What it would allow is the flexibility for nursing homes to charge more to those who can afford it. Now, granted, there are parts of the state where nursing homes will not be able to do that because their mix will not allow that, and they're still going to need help. You know, we don't want to take that help away. But where that is possible, it allows us to stop the cycle of telling people they should sell off their assets and go on MA in order to get nursing home coverage. We need to try to keep people who don't necessarily need to be on MA off of MA because of the expense and because we want to reserve those resources for those who need it most. So I'm not sure it's going to create those inequities across the state. What it will allow is for nursing homes to charge, in some cases, a differential rate for people who don't need to be on MA and can pay it themselves. It's another source of revenue for them. It helps keep the nursing home healthy, and hopefully we keep more people off of MA.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hayden.
To that point. You know, that's interesting, Representative Gottwald, because I really see it the opposite. So, and I'm not saying that you're wrong at all. I'm just saying that I see that actually folks would be charged a higher rate and then thus would spend their income down over time or much faster, along with my other comment about them taking, you know, them being marketed flat screen TVs or whatever people think is a luxury these days, but having that kind of situation happen where they actually would pay more for services that they need or that they, you know, that they want, and then when that money is gone, then they would turn around and then they would go on MA. So to me, I thought the rate reduction in concept, and I, Mr. Coleman, maybe, you know, help me with this because I'm not an expert there. I thought that it did exactly the opposite of Representative Gottwald said.
Representative, or Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Sorry for that insult. Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Sorry for that insult.
No, sometimes it's easier to be on the other side of the table. Not always. Certainly, it could have that impact upon some individuals. But, again, I'll repeat, we don't know that because we've never tested the market. Will people select a nursing facility as the place to receive their services if the price is greater than it is right now? There are some people who are choosing other services at a greater cost today who are paying privately. And I guess you could say they are spending down faster in other locations because those costs are higher. We're really trying to allow for the elderly to have choices and yet at the same time allow some flexibility for all of the long-term care providers, including the nursing facilities, to determine what they need to charge to sustain their business. A growing component, or what we hope will be a growing component in the long-term care system, is long-term care insurance. And to the extent that facilities are able to price their services along those lines, as opposed to relying upon a state-set Medicaid rate, may be an additional benefit that allows people to diversify their payer sources and provide for less pressure upon the medical assistance budget also.
Representative Broad gets the last question.
Wow, I get the last word. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. Actually, I just want to give the governor's office some credit and the department some credit for touching the untouchable. This is a politically difficult issue on both sides of the aisle as we struggle to figure out how to afford an unaffordable wave that's coming toward us. And so I think this issue is a significant one. And Representative Hayden, I think your concerns are fair. The only thing I would say is that just from my perspective is that it's not the case that the sky is the limit on where they can go, because most of the nursing homes understand their businesses, they got to keep their doors open. And the good thing in terms of keeping those costs in check for the private payers is that there's all sorts of other options out there that we didn't have years ago when this policy was put into place. We didn't have the home care. We didn't have the PCA services. We didn't have those. I don't think we had the bulk of the opportunities to stay in your home that we have today. And so I think that those alternatives to stay out of a nursing home are going to help keep those costs in check for those private payers. And so while we enter into this very difficult and politically difficult discussion, I just think that this is one that is really important for us to have as we, you know, the numbers just are going to demand that we do some things differently. And so I know that we're going to be able to work together on this one. It's not an easy one.
Mr. Coleman, is that your last page?
Mr. Chair, that is.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Coleman. And unfortunately, we're going to have to come back to this room at 6:30 tonight. So we are recessing the meeting. Actually, I don't think I ever started the meeting today. I'll call the meeting to order, and now the meeting's adjourned.
Recess.
Okay, we'll call the Health and Human Services Finance Committee back to order.
Don't forget to approve those minutes, ma'am.
And we even though the table looks empty, we did recess, so technically we have a quorum. There's multiple committees going on in the state office building, so that's why we're missing some members. But we'll move forward on the agenda and get something done instead of just wait and twiddle our thumbs. So the next person is Billy Joel Zielinski and Assistant Commissioner Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg. I'm the state Medicaid director, but I also have responsibility for managed care contracting and inpatient policy. So I'm going to address those budget pages that relate to those areas.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Billy Joe Zielinski. I'm the health care assistant commissioner, and I will be addressing those that are dealing with the subsidized health care programs for Minnesota health care.
And welcome to the committee, and Mr. Osberg, I gave you the wrong title. I guess titles have changed in the last few months, so I apologize for that.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, referring to the, I think it's your fifth section. It's the third blue section from the back. It's the health care section, obviously. I don't know. I'm not sure if your sections are numbered, but... It's the healthcare section. First budget page is the increased Minnesota Care Managed Care withhold. Is everyone there?
Okay. Yeah. All right, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
this proposal recommends increasing the amount withheld for Minnesota Care Managed Care contracts by an additional 3 percentage points beginning calendar year 2011. And let me just give you a background on the withhold that we have with managed care payments. So we've had a withhold for some time. This we've had an 8% withhold in medical assistance, and now we have a 5% withhold for Minnesota Care. Last year, the governor proposed, and the legislature actually attempted to enact a 8% withhold for Minnesota Care, but the language to authorize that was not included in the legislation. So with this, there would be an 8% withhold from the managed care payments for both medical assistance and Minnesota Care. Now, 5% of that withhold is returned based on performance. The other 3% is not. The other 3% is a delay in terms of payment, by and large. So this 3%, additional 3%, would not be subject to a performance by the managed care organizations. The other 5% that's currently in place would be. Now, this results in a savings of $7.7 million in the Healthcare Access Fund and $24 million in this biennium and $24 million in the Healthcare Access Fund in the next biennium.
Mr. Osberg, I think every budget period that I've at least been involved in, we've had a withhold. A certain percentage withhold every single deficit that we've gone through. At what point do we continue down this road where we're no longer actuarially sound in our managed care rates?
Mr. Chairman, we're there. 8% is about all we can do in terms of withholding payments from the managed care organizations. Certainly, it's a big cash flow issue for them as well. But this is as far as we can go. In our opinion, it would be 8%.
So after, Mr. Osberg, after a number of years of using this tactic and knowing that we are most likely going to be facing a significant shortfall next biennium, is it in your opinion this is probably the tipping point for the withhold?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
Yeah, and is the, in 2014 then, is that all come paid back then? Is that, if the chart stops at 13, but is there a positive number then? Is this a temporary withhold or
yes,
a permanent?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a withhold that's paid back, Mr. Chairman. In fact, in this case, the return would be made between July, in the month of July, after the fiscal year involved. So it's a delay into the next fiscal year.
But there's never a positive number then. In 2014, the number doesn't. I thought I remember there was some. Payback.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, no, this goes on indefinitely in terms right. of the withhold. There's no, it's not a, it's a shift that goes forward forever.
that's fine for now. Thanks.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members, page 2 of your book, this proposal will reduce by 3%. The fee-for-service rates paid for inpatient hospital services, what we call a ratable reduction. This proposal excludes facilities operated by the Indian Health Services. It also, though, captures the effect and the savings, the full savings for the entire year in the managed care arrangement by putting that reduction in the January 1-11 contract. So we're suggesting not to make an amendment to the contract mid-year on this. We're suggesting to wait until January 1st. However, we want to capture the entire savings. So we're talking about a July 1 effective date for this ratable reduction. And this is on top of the current ratable reductions in statute. Again, as you're familiar with, I believe. And so, but this would result then in savings of $7.3 million in this current biennium in the general fund and $1.9 million in the Healthcare Access Fund. And then in the next biennium, it's $35 million in the general fund and $10 million in the Healthcare Access Fund for this 3% ratable reduction from hospitals.
Mr. Osberg, again, this is this is familiar territory for our budgets. At we've reduced rates to hospitals, I'd probably say, more aggressively than any other ratable reduction we've had, whether it's to long-term care facilities, group homes, whatnot. What level are we at for payments to hospitals? I mean, are we paying what we did in 2000 or back in 1990? We're definitely below, you know, where we've been.
Mr. Chair, again, there's multiple ways by which we pay hospitals. We pay hospitals through what's called DSH payments, yep, quarterly payments. We pay hospitals, some hospitals for a small rural hospital, for example, an add-on for them between 15% and 20%. We pay hospitals in different ways. So a rateable reduction of 3%. Also, we do what's called rebasing. No other provider group within Medicaid has what's called, except for nursing facilities, has called something called rebasing, whereby every so often, by statute, every other year by statute, we increase the payments to hospitals based on their actual cost. And now that was delayed, last time we did this, 2007, so right, 2009, the law skipped the 2009 rebasing, and we're about to, later on here, you can see that we're going to delay by 3 months rebasing again for 2011. So, but rebasing does not apply to any other acute care provider other than hospitals. Like for physicians or dentists, for example, don't get a rebased payment every other year in statute. I'm not suggesting that this is not a big hit on hospitals. It is. And this, so if you take this in with the other proposals that we have here, it's a hit on the hospitals. And as to where they're at this point, we could maybe figure that out in terms of what percentage of billed charges, though that's not the best way to look at this. But we can give you ideas to some history on this. But the rateable reductions have taken place the last 4 or 5 years, and right now it's 14.5% on the non-mental health side, this adds another 3%. And you don't make that up in the rebasing. I want to make that clear. I'm not suggesting that with the rebasing makes up the rateable reductions. It does not. I want to make sure that the members understand that.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Osberg. In the recent history, there's been a 14.5% reduction, and this 3% is on top of that.
Mr. Chairman, yes, for the non-mental health piece. For the mental health, is a 1.5% rateable reduction. And you got to remember, the mental health is a huge percentage of our hospital payments, by definition. So this rateable reduction does apply to mental health. So it would be a 4.5% rateable reduction for mental health DRGs or services with this budget proposal.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment on that topic of that the hospitals have been hit quite severely over time is that I think historically, although they've only been here 3 years, so history is pretty short, but what I picked up from the discussions is that the thought was that hospitals had greater ability than other players possibly to do cost shifting onto the private pay patients, and it just would become an add-on basically to the private side of further cuts on the public side. What I think we've heard from the hospitals in the last couple of years, particularly in the big discussions last year at the very large initial cuts that were proposed, is that they're no longer able to do that shifting effectively, that the big employer groups and the big plans being hired by the big employer groups and individual employers are basically saying we're no longer willing to increase our rates, compensate for cost shifting that occurs. That there's been a huge pushback, and so it really is just diving into the hospital margins. And last year, with those initial overall large cuts proposed, we had, for the first time in my 3 years, had the CFOs, not just the lobbyists for the hospital in our office. We had the financial people from all the hospitals in our office. And I just think that things have changed in terms of hospitals' abilities to continue to take these kinds of rate cuts, and will so more dramatically in the year ahead. So I think we need to be cognizant of the historical reasons for doing that may no longer be true.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question I have to do is in the box. It's a description and the brief background. And there's a second sentence in there that says, this proposal excludes facilities operated by the Indian Health Service and Indian tribes from this reduction. Maybe you could explain a little bit more about that exception.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, yes, Indian Health Services, there's actually 100% federal money. And we facilitate that to make sure Indian Health Services get to the accurate amount of money, that the correct amount of money for their services. So we don't, we would not be in a position to do that anyway, I guess. But I just want, we want to point it out that there's no effect on Indian Health Services.
Okay, thank you.
Continue, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, direct your attention now to page 3. This proposal eliminates coverage of physical, occupational, and speech therapies for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above on Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance effective January 1, 2011. Therapy will continue to be available in inpatient settings. Rehabilitative services, which include physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech-language pathology, and audiology services, are categorized as optional rather than mandatory for certain populations as defined by the federal regulations. In the fiscal year 2010-2011, this proposal will save $1.8 million from the general fund and $285,000 in the healthcare access fund. In fiscal year 2012-13, $11.5 million in the general fund and $1.3 million in the healthcare access fund. Currently, rehabilitative services are available to all Minnesota healthcare program participants, whether under fee-for-service or managed care plans. The elderly and disabled with long-term chronic and debilitating conditions, as well as children with chronic lifelong conditions such as cerebral palsy, receive the majority of rehabilitative service paid by our Minnesota healthcare programs. Medicare includes coverage for rehabilitative services and for those recipients that are duly eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. Minnesota healthcare program pays their co-insurance and deductible, and it is anticipated that this will continue should the rehabilitative services be eliminated from this benefit set. For children who are under age 21, the program will continue to include rehabilitative services under the early and periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment benefit, but many children with lifelong disabling conditions receive PTOT and speech-language pathology over and above the EPSDT benefit set. This proposal assumed that 50% of the therapy spending on MA families and children and 90% of the therapy spending in elderly and disabled are for adults, and 70% of the savings are shifted to other services.
Representative Abler, how did I know that you had a question?
Oh, well, just lucky guess. is this, I'm not going to discuss the merits of this. No one likes any of these, so I'm not here for that part. But in this exclusion, is it the CPT code that's excluded or the provider who's excluded?
Representative Abler, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, it would be the services would be excluded.
All right, thanks. So it's the codes that are not right. Paid for, not the provider. Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Two questions. One is the add back there at the end, just so people in the room are clear. So to the extent that we cut these services in the clinic and home savings, what you meant by add back is that more of them will be occurring in the hospital or hospital-like, and I'll get to that point in a minute, settings. And therefore, you've had to add 70% of the savings from the home and clinic cut back to the budget. So these items in the budget sheet here reflect the net effect of those two things.
That is correct.
I want a little clarity on, before I was thinking it was outpatient versus inpatient, but the wording here is clinic and home base. So nursing homes and TUCs, they would be considered still covered, but not clinic and home base. So they are still covered. See, I thought they were going to be excluded as well. Okay. We know hospitals still covered, but are TUCs and nursing homes still covered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, and I apologize. I'm new.
Okay.
I don't know
That's
if you know
okay.
that, Representative. Only 7 months on the job, so looking to the experts. Okay, we will have to get back to you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay.
Representative Bunn.
Okay. That's a very important issue, I think, in terms of if TUC and and nursing homes weren't covered, we're talking about keeping people in hospitals much longer, okay, probably in many of these cases. And so rather than releasing them to other institutions, and certainly we're keeping them in institutions longer, and that's the add-back part, rather than releasing them to their home care. So certainly that has personal impacts, if not also overall impacts in a variety of ways. The last paragraph in terms of who would continue to receive these benefits under other eligibilities, whether you or whether the department can really spell that out for me in the next day or so in terms of what is meant by that, who in fact would retain coverage and what level of coverage, and how would it differ from their current coverage under that last paragraph. So I'd like to see much more detail on that piece. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, we certainly will. It is in statute, and so we certainly can do that for you.
Representative Bunn.
And one final thing on the issue of the add backs, if I could also see a breakdown of the add backs by kind of categories here, not just overall, I'd like to see that as well in terms of how the add back works across the different categories.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to kind of piggyback on Representative Bunn's line of questioning, just in a real simple term. So if somebody, and Representative Bunn used this example the other day, if somebody has a hip replacement, they're going to be in the hospital for a little bit of time, but then they typically, I think, are going to be recuperating in a long-term care facility potentially. So will that PT and OT be available to them at that time? Or that's what we're trying to figure out, right, if that's not. I just wanted to make it more concrete. Okay, thank you.
And to follow up on this, just a couple questions. One is, now, last year we had recommendations not only for PT, OT, speech pathology, but also dental and chiropractic. What was the thought process in coming forward with this proposal?
Well, we recognize that trying to achieve a $1.2 billion deficit has some, it's going to impact many different services and recipients and providers. I think that this was one of the areas that we could achieve some savings as an optional program.
Was there any weight into, you know, removing these services as a benefit under MA, the impact that would have on potential rehospitalizations?
Mr. Chair, we looked at many different options. This is the one that is before you. I don't know all the idiosyncrasies with regards to how this recommendation. I'll be quite candid with you.
Thank you. Representative Bunn.
Two follow-up questions. One is on the point here. More specifically within what he just asked is, can we hear an explanation of why in the department's view chiropractor was left completely untouched while including these categories?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I certainly can get back to you on that.
Well, and one reason I ask that, because I've been studying all these categories and comparisons with all the other states and things like that in the last week as part of one of many other projects, but, you know, several of these categories have, like, lifetime limits on them, for lack of example, in PT in terms of the number of care units they can receive, I think 120 units, whereas there's annual limits for chiro, but there's no lifetime limit that I could see. So correct me if I'm wrong on this part, but anyways. So I was a bit confused that it seemed like already some of these categories were tighter than the chiro. And maybe there's good medical reasons for all that, but I don't know enough about it. So I was trying to seek further clarification why that was.
Okay.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to offer a little insight on that little element, they pay pocket change to start with. In terms of the reimbursement rates, they pay, I think, about $14 a visit or something on a charge of 50. The therapy visits are closer to 100 in their charges. And in terms of to actually cut it would cost money because it's a low-cost provider and it actually prevents other care from being necessary. So I think they finally realize that. So that's what my observation is. And there's a bunch of data about that if you want it sometime.
Okay, we can continue.
Okay. Authorization is needed.
authorizations are
Assistant Commissioner.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'll be honest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, your point about lifetime limits, that really aren't lifetime limits on these services. There's a point in which you have to get reauthorization.
That's correct, right.
That's what I think you're referring to, right?
Right.
Right. Yes. That's, we don't have lifetime limits on any of our services, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Another question?
I was going to clarify further, but that's right.
Okay, let's continue.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 5, this proposal eliminates a portion of the medical education and research cost payments, the MERC payments, attributable managed care. We have managed care carve-out payments, and then we have fee-for-service. And we've had, a couple of years ago, the federal government limited how much we could actually claim federal reimbursement on our MERC. So that's affected us in the last couple of years as well. But what this does is this... There's two parts of the managed care MERC payments. One is a general distribution that goes to outpatient and mostly inpatient providers. Like 80% or maybe 90% of the MERC payments on the general distribution side go to hospitals for medical education training, and the rest go to outpatient settings or outpatient situations. Then we have another payment. It's $21 million payment that's a fixed payment that goes to Hempa County Medical Center and the University of Minnesota. We're not touching that in this page. We're touching, though, the payments that go for the general distribution. Now, as you see on this page, it's about a $19 million state savings, but I need to let you know that it's a total of $49 million hit, because we have the rest of it is federal share. And we can share with you exactly how we distribute, or how the health department, what we do is that we raise the money and the health department distributes the money to medical education providers throughout the state. And we can share with you that kind of impact. But I just want to let you know that it's the general distribution side of the MERC payments that we're cutting, not the fixed payment that goes to the university and to Hempa County Medical Center. And as I said, there's an $18 million savings associated with this, but the cut to those providers is greater than that. I need to let you know that it's a total of $49 million cut to providers. And the health department also has a MERC proposal that reduces not this much, but reduces some of the payments to the University of Minnesota on the MERC payment they have using the tobacco fund money. So in the tobacco fund money, they still have or the tobacco tax money. They still have some of that. And so you need to look at this in conjunction with the health department's MERC budget page as well.
Representative Rudin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So will this impact, like, the other, like, Methodist Hospital or other hospitals that maybe do some training in their facility but not to the extent of Hennepin County?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rudin, it affects all of them. But again, Hempa County Medical Center gets paid from both of those, the general distribution fund and from the fixed fund. But there's a broader, there's many hospitals get paid out of the general distribution fund.
Mr. Osberg, the not touching HCMC and the University of Minnesota, are those MERC funds also tied to additional federal funds?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Indeed, same share.
So any MERC funding that you cut is going to have a corresponding loss of federal dollars.
Right. And right now we're in a period of enhanced federal match, as you may know, and that's why it's that's why the numbers can come up the way they do.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Now, page 6. I thought Brian was able to. Thank you very much, Mr. Osberg, for. Saving me. I thought you were also going to mention something about some federal dollars that just set the tone.
Oh, well, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think what Assistant Commissioner Zielinski is talking about is that this past week we received some good news. I should probably led with this, and that is, we have been the last couple of months. We working with other states, as other Medicaid agencies, to challenge CMS in their interpretation of the law that, in terms of the what's called the Medicare Part D clawback. When Medicare Part D went into effect a few years ago, federal government wanted to take the savings from the states because then we were relieved of that cost. Because we have 100,000 clients who are both on Medicare and Medicaid, and up to that point, of course, Medicaid paid for drugs. And then went all over to Medicare after Medicare Part D went into effect. But what they did is they applied the old federal match of 50% to that calculation instead of the new enhanced federal match of 61.59%, which is the federal match we have until the end of this calendar year. So we and other states challenged CMS on that, and then this past week, they then determined that they were going to make the correction and give us that that additional money. It's $81 million for this biennium. And that will be captured, that $81 million will be captured in the forecast that comes out next week. So you'll see it there. So we have, I'm not sure what else is going to happen in the forecast, but at least that part of it is going to be $81 million less. Thanks for the opportunity.
But we'll have a $1.12 billion deficit, hopefully. Go downward.
Hopefully it's lower than that.
I hope so.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you for that. All right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, page 6. This proposal would modify the criteria to qualify for critical access dental add-on payments. Under this proposal, significantly fewer dentists would qualify for the payment, and this proposal does dovetails with the one-time CAD elimination of the in the unallotment package. We want to save money, but we want to preserve the critical access dental add-on dental payments continue for clinics with a mission to serve disproportionately large numbers of public program clients, uninsured and underinsured individuals regardless of their ability to pay. This proposal will save $3 million in fiscal year 2010-11 in the healthcare access fund. In fiscal year 2012-13, it will save $8 million in the general fund and $13.2 million in the healthcare access fund. This proposal alters the criteria for dentists to be designated CAD providers under medical assistance in Minnesota Care. Specifically, state law would require that CAD providers be nonprofit community clinics that have nonprofit status as specified under state law, have tax exempt status as provided in Internal Revenue Code Section 501c3, are established to provide oral health services to low-income population groups, uninsured, high-risk, and special needs populations, underserved, and other special needs populations, have professional staff familiar with cultural background of clients, charge for services on a sliding fee scale designed to provide assistance to low-income clients based on current poverty income guidelines and family size, do not restrict access or services because of clients' financial limitations or public assistance status, and have free care available as needed. In addition, the federally qualified health care centers, rural health care centers, public health clinics, state-operated dental clinics, and county-based hospital clinics are eligible for the designation as a CAD provider.
Representative Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, and Chris or others from the department can correct me on this, but based on my discussions with various kinds of providers in the last week, so far I've determined that this criteria eliminates, first of all, the University of Minnesota Dental School, which currently provides care for low-income critical access patients. HCMC views that they are eliminated under this. Health Partners, which serves over 10,000, thinks they are eliminated under this. The Fairview System, which serves over 10,000, they claim it would be eliminated. Any private practice dentist currently serving appears to be eliminated, including one private practice that claims they've been serving 10,000. Maybe that'd be over time then, so I got to see clarification on this within this program in the last many years. There's some aspects of the criteria that was established that I think were attractive as a way of narrowing, but overall, of course, our private dental sector feels that it's a fairly significant assault on their sector being involved in this program, obviously. But moreover, I'm concerned about
not only in the metro, some historically large providers that have served in this area being excluded, particularly our dental school students who get that training both at the dental school at the U, but also at HGMC, and also there are two outstate satellites for the dental school also are excluded according to the dean of the dental school under this criteria. So all the training spots for our dental students, he believes, are excluded under this criteria. In addition to that, although I've requested further information on the geographic distribution, I'm concerned that narrowing it to just two rural clinics, that there are outstate areas that will be left significantly uncovered by any kind of critical access provider potentially. Now, all those places, of course, could continue to ride with the regular rate, but not a critical access rate. So the question is, any of those institutions I just mentioned or outside, whether they have a viable business model that works without this rate, and some claim they don't, but I don't know the accuracy of that. So there's certainly some concerns out there about what this is doing, and there will be an alternative proposal coming forward shortly for discussion as we move forward. If you have any comments you could make tonight about the outstate distribution issue and access issue, but secondly about the general whether you understood when making this designation criteria that all those groups I just mentioned would be falling out of the system, particularly our dental school training system and HCMC. Could you clarify for me whether you understood that this eliminated those kinds of groups? One feature, when I was trying to think what's consistent across all the groups, they're all large systems. You know, they're so I don't know. One question I had for you as a department when thinking about that was the thought that these large systems, whether it's a Health Partners or HCMC or the University of Minnesota, could shift, still take these patients, but shift the cost, you know, onto other parts of the system, whereas small clinics that do just this stuff, this type of work, can't really do that. So you were trying to preserve those smaller units that couldn't survive without this while letting the others do the best they could to absorb it. I guess that's another part. So those are kind of the questions that I have this evening. If you have any further clarification on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I do know with regards to the University of Minnesota, because this had been brought up as mm-hmm. well, that and there may be others who qualify and make changes to qualify, but I know that Chris Reisdorf, a member of my staff, has spoken with you and also with the University mm-hmm. of Minnesota, and they may qualify at some of their teaching sites, and they may also make changes so that they qualify as a community clinic as defined in this proposal. And I do understand the volume, that it is a significant number of dentists, but we won't know exactly the number unless this proposal is taken up as for your consideration.
Representative Bunn.
One other question, and maybe Chris can answer that tonight, is, or you can stay after Chris and talk to me a little bit if you want, is the issue of these systems. I mean, Health Partners has a clinic within its system that has, you know, 95%, you know, public program patients, and they're a nonprofit of sorts, but I'm not sure if they meet all these nonprofit criteria. But of course, the overall system doesn't. So I don't know if even a clinic within a system could be counted separately in terms of meeting the criteria. Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
welcome to the committee, and please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Chris Reiser from the Department of Human Services. I think that, I think the Hennepin County Medical Center would qualify under this proposal as a county-based hospital clinic system. Hennepin County would be included in that. I did talk to someone at the University of Minnesota, as Assistant Commissioner Zielinski said, that they are looking into possibly changing some guidelines of their own clinics to qualify under these conditions. But you are also correct, Representative Bunn, in that there are a number of systems that would not be included in this current proposal. I think part of what we were looking at is continuing the critical access add-on money for clinics that are least able to make up the difference between serving large groups of uninsured and non-commercial programs.
We can continue.
Mr. Chairman, members, on page 8. Now, this proposal eliminates the enhanced payment to hospitals in greater Minnesota, what referred to as the rural DRG payment, the add-on to those hospitals. What happens now is that, as you know, under the current statute, hospitals get paid based on their specific cost structure, and that's what we rebase every 2 years under statute. So it's a very unique arrangement, and it's based on the hospital's cost structure. What statute does today is says that for certain DRGs, and these are mental health and delivery DRGs, these 16 DRGs fall in those two categories. For those 16 DRGs, these hospitals would get paid the greater of the 90% of the metro average, which includes medical education costs, includes other costs, or their actual costs. So it's an add-on. They don't get penalized. They don't get paid less than what they would otherwise get paid. But if they get paid less than 90% of the metro average, they get an add-on for those 16 DRGs. Now, also, small rural hospitals, about 90 of them, get paid a 15 or 20% add-on as well. That's separate from the rural DRG payment. As we talked about last year, Mr. Chair, we have a very complicated set of arrangements to pay hospitals. And I think we would like to revisit what we talked about last year in terms of showing you how hospitals get paid so you understand the effect of some of these cuts. And but that's not normally understood, is that there's also a small rural hospital add-on as well as this non-metro or greater Minnesota add-on. I'm saying it's still a cut. Cut is a cut, and it affects those hospitals that may be higher than that may be eligible for the 90% of metro average. But I think we should look and revisit, nothing else, revisit the logic behind it as to whether or not that's the right way of going about this. I know Representative Huntley and I have had a lot of discussions about this issue over the years about the very issue, and I'm glad to continue my discussion with him about it. But frankly, I think we need to look at redesigning entirely the way we pay for hospitals. I mean, it's Medicare discontinued a cost reimbursement system about 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago now, in terms of paying for hospitals, and we still have a cost reimbursement system under Medicaid here. And maybe in the context of payment reform and other things, as we look down the future in terms of paying providers and getting away from a fee-for-service system into more of a total cost of care or gain-sharing arrangement, that we could revisit this. But we have a complicated set of payment mechanisms for hospitals, and this is one of them. I'm not suggesting that we're cutting here or eliminating this because it's complicated. We're doing this because we need savings, and frankly, and as you see here, the savings are not all that great compared to others. $2 million for this current biennium, but close to $9 million for the next biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Osberg, and just because it's getting late, I won't go on too much, but I would have to say I strongly agree with Representative Huntley's viewpoint on the DRG catch-up, or if you'd like to call it an add-on. So, Representative Rudin.
Thank you. Mr. Osberg, looking at the different categories that are listed, most of them have to do in some way with OB care or newborn care. Do you have concerns about hospitals deciding that they won't allow deliveries at their hospitals, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, no, I don't necessarily. Again, they get paid for that. They get paid what other hospitals would get paid, and that is based on their cost structure. But it lags for, you know, the calculation lags 4 years. That's true. But
excuse me, Mr. Chair, with malpractice and just there, at some point there's a breaking point for providers, I think, to feel comfortable that they can continue to provide that care.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Rudin, you're making a very good point about these type of DRGs, the mental health and OB DRGs are not big winners for hospitals in general. So it's difficult financially for them to begin with, no matter if it's this program or any other, even in the commercial side. So it is a challenge for hospitals. I recognize that to have a viable mental health or OB service. And but I don't believe this in itself is going to cause them not to do this. That's my visceral response. I don't have any analysis that I can offer you at this point, Representative Rood.
Mr. Chair, no, I'll direct your attention to page 10. This proposal reduces the eligibility for adults without children in Minnesota care from 250% of poverty to 75% of the federal poverty guidelines effective October 1, 2010. This proposal saves $130 million in fiscal year 2010-11, $510 million in the fiscal year 2012-13. This proposal will decrease enrollment by 28,000 enrollees in FY11. Proposal will not violate the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act maintenance of effort requirement because Minnesota Care adults, as you know, without children, are not a federally funded eligibility group.
Question? Representative Abler.
Well, just I saw there's a healthcare access fund chart here too. This is probably a good time just to ask my question about that, and I'm sure no one at the table likes this either, so we don't have to spend much time doing that. But even with that, which is a big change, and it'll be discussed, I'm sure, more at a later time, the healthcare access fund still goes broke in 2012. If nothing changes, let's say this goes forward somehow, and then this chart becomes current law. What happens? What's the next thing to happen in the healthcare access fund? We would transfer money from the general fund to do this for the first cycle, and then the second cycle, something would happen. Is that right? Can you just comment about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I would like to know, is it the chart that's in the...
The healthcare access fund chart? Oh,
I believe, Mr. Chair, Representative, you're looking at the healthcare access fund forecast.
Right, February 2010, Governor's Rex.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, that is something actually that Jane had addressed initially, but
all right. Hoping. And Representative Abler, before Ms. Rankin comes up, I think that chart also assumes the auto enrollment into Minnesota Care. For GAMC folks.
And I don't want to drag this out long. I'm just, short answers are fine. And so my two questions are, if this forecast, if this chart happens, and at the end of 2012, you're short $87 million, well, just you tell me what happens then.
If you can state your name for the committee, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the budget director at DHS, and I apologize, Representative Abler, and would like to ask you to back up. Which chart are you looking at?
The healthcare access fund forecast. It was on my desk. The fund balance.
From the governor's rec or from the – what does it say at the top?
It's February 23rd, 2010, okay. Governor's rec. That was just a germane question since you're on that part of the budget there. So.
And could you direct me to the lines that you were looking at?
Well, the balance on the last, on the bottom line, we're short $87 million in 2012.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, this fund balance is shows the projected status of the healthcare access fund, assuming that this budget page is enacted.
Yeah.
And also assuming that the current law movement of folks who would be leaving GAMC are moving over to Minnesota Care.
Okay.
And so your question about the out years is?
Well, so we can't spend money we haven't got. So as I understand, I think we'd have to backfill that with general fund dollars for the first cycle, and then we have to unenroll somebody in the second cycle? Or just tell me that. Just the short version of that is all I'm after. I'm just trying to get my hands around it.
Got it. I apologize for being a little slow on the uptake here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you are correct. Under current law, there is a provision that applies through the end of the 10-11 biennium to where if there is a deficit in the health care access fund, the general fund moves over, fills in, there's an automatic transfer to meet those obligations. That provision of law expires with the end of the 10-11 biennium. So then you're left in a situation where the health care access fund, if this fund balance were to hold for 12 and 13, you have a situation where you don't have enough resources possibly to serve the people in Minnesota Care. And there's currently a statute that DHS would operate under, and it specifies steps that we are to take to disenroll and do other program management activities to bring the demands on the fund balance back in line with the resources that are projected.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler,
for the first swipe through, what group would be disenrolled first?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it's discontinued enrollment first, yeah, and then adults without kids is the first. I mean, discontinued enrollment first. And I think we have to actually disenroll people. It begins with adults without kids, if I recall.
And so would that be the people under 75%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, at that point, yes, given that if this page was adopted, that's all we would have under Minnesota Care is adults without kids under 75%.
Thank you. That's what I was. Correct. I mean, I'm just going to get the discussion in the hallways clear, so that helped me.
And Ms. Rankin, to follow up a little bit on that, if we didn't do the auto enrollment plan that the governor recommends, what would this fund balance look like?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't recall. What I recall is Mr. Hoffman explaining that the auto enrollment feature is something that affects just the current group of people who are in transitional Minnesota Care, and it doesn't really impact otherwise. What's going to happen is operating under the Minnesota Care statute, which is essentially that folks who have up until now been served on GAMC would be eligible for Minnesota Care and will find their way over to Minnesota Care. And I think that this fund balance that you see in front of you, the reason that there's a deficit projected in the health care access fund in 12 and 13 is because of assumptions that Mr. Hoffman and his economists have made about how many of those current GAMC eligible populations will make their way over to Minnesota Care. I know there is an incremental dollar value assigned to just the auto enrollment piece of this, but I don't have that information with me.
Well, I'm just looking at the total expenditures line, and from 2009 to 2010, total expenditures increase well over 50% over what we're currently spending in 2009, and I'm assuming that's a result of the GAMC recipients moving into Minnesota Care, and that trend continues for all the alt years.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask that a different staff person address your programmatic questions.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I think the cost of auto enrollment to the Healthcare Access Fund over the fiscal year 10 through fiscal year 13 period is about $284 million. That's the cost of moving the current GMC population over to Minnesota Care.
So the $257 million deficit projected in 2013 would be substantially different if we did not do the auto enrollment.
Mr. Chair, I think I think it's a little more complicated than that, but it's hard to really tell where it would be. I think we'd have to give it some thought on where, because there's a lot of moving pieces between this proposal and what's being done with the auto enrollment. Okay. But it would be less, I think.
Okay.
Representative Abler.
One more question.
Then we'll move on. I apologize for the question.
In the forecast, in the forecast that we were, must be the November forecast, there's $109 million or something that the general fund backfills into the healthcare access fund. That doesn't happen in this scenario, in the page in front of us, or is that built into this also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it does not happen in this proposal.
Thank you. Helps me understand the question.
Welcome back, and we'll continue on to the next change item.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this proposal increases the max, page 13. This proposal increases the maximum Minnesota Care premium from 7.2% to 8.8% of the household income effective July 1 of 2011. This proposal will save $9.5 million in fiscal year 12-13 in the Healthcare Access Fund, and under this proposal, enrollment will decrease by 239 enrollees in 2011, approximately 882 enrollees in 2012, and 1,143 enrollees in 2013. Under this proposal, Minnesota Care premiums would revert from the current scale with the maximum premium of 7.2% of household income to the prior premium scale with a maximum premium of 8.8% of household income. Since this would maintain Minnesota Care premiums within the ceiling set out by in the Minnesota Care waiver, an amendment to the waiver, federal waiver, would not be needed.
Next, please.
Okay, page 14. This proposal gives the Commissioner the authority to carry forward the unexpended FY 2010 appropriation for the state COBRA subsidy program in 2011. The additional funds will cover the cost of complying with the new federal COBRA subsidy provisions. The change has no fiscal impact. The state COBRA legislation passed in 2009 appropriated $22.6 million in FY10 and $6.9 million in FY11 to pay for the state subsidy on the COBRA premiums. The fiscal note projected that the subsidies would result in a reduction in the costs for Minnesota Care and medical assistant programs, but that the program would result in a net cost to the state. Early experience with the program has found that expenditures on the state premium subsidies have been much lower than anticipated. Likewise, savings to the Minnesota healthcare programs have been much lower than expected. This proposal would authorize the carry forward of the original 2009 appropriation for the state COBRA premium subsidies, which will be sufficient to cover both the cost of complying with the changes in the COBRA subsidy program on the federal level and allow the Minnesota COBRA subsidy to be extended to correspond with the changes in the federal COBRA subsidy.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we have a proposal in this area again this year for extension, do we know why expenditures were less than expected, why demand? Maybe, what explains that? I mean, just not as many people requested it. I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, and I know not all the cases. Okay, I'm going to have.
Sorry.
I know this question came up too in the Senate, and I was hoping to be able to answer. Going to. Okay. It was a phase in of people. Representative Bunn, Chair, and it has taken time. We will hopefully be able to capture savings in the long term over the longer time frame than this biennium.
I was asked what the question. The question is, so this is that COBRA extension. The feds were going to give us 65%. We were going to do the 35%, and they said they had much less expenditure in this category than they expected. Is that because people weren't aware of the program and opportunity, so ended up dropping their COBRAs and then therefore ended up as an expense on our other public programs? Or is it because they didn't, you know, continue their COBRAs and paid for it themselves or just took the federal subsidy, or because fewer people had COBRA issues than we thought they were going to have? I mean, I just want to know, given we have another proposal for this, I want to know kind of what was going on underneath the surface.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, we don't know at this time, but we will try to analyze that information.
Okay. Thank you. We'll continue.
And Mr. Chair, the last budget page is page 16. This proposal delays the hospital rebasing that I was talking about earlier. Under current law, the hospital's payment will be rebased effective in January of 2011. And also, based on what happened last year in terms of legislation that was enacted, that the hospitals will get roughly 74% of the value of that. Not 100%, but 74%. And then on April 1st of 2011, they get 39% under current law, the value of the rebasing for a year. And then it goes to full value. Mm-hmm. So what this proposal does is it eliminates that 74% for the first 3 months. And that's all it does. It continues current law mm-hmm. after that. And so it eliminates, in essence, the rebasing for that the first 3 months of calendar year 11. And now, again, this is not a rate decrease, but this is a decrease in future rate increases. I just want to make sure that's understood. It still obviously affects hospital payments in the future, but it's not a current rate decrease. And, Mr. Chair, as you see on the page, it's $8.6 million in savings for this biennium and $4.8 million in the next.
Any further questions? Any further? One of the materials that you gave for the committee was a list of the unallotments mm-hmm. From the governor's decision after last session. Did you have anything to add on that, or is that just for our information only? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Ms. Rankin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jane Rankin, Budget Director with the Department of Human Services. Yes, Representative Huntley had requested that I review the piece. There's a part of the governor's budget recommendations that has to do with the unallotments from last summer, and there's a one-page handout I will go over with you. I wanted to take just a minute, though, and back up to a page in the healthcare area. Budget page 11, it's titled Technical Correction. And I wanted to mention this to you because this is something that has been involving a lot of my time in the months since the end of last session. Essentially, what this page is speaking to is that there are a few special situations where DHS gets legislative authorization to keep the federal share that we earn on certain activities. The standard way that we operate is that when we are doing our work, if it's an activity that's allowable for federal reimbursement, you appropriate the full dollar amount for the activity to us. We do the work, and then the federal government reimburses a federal share, federal financial participation, and that money goes to the general fund directly. It doesn't go through the agency. This page is speaking to two situations where we do something a little different. There's been longstanding riders in the budget bills that give the department the authority to retain the federal shares for two different activities. The first is the utilization review contract. This is the work that we do for prior authorization and other utilization review activities in the MA program. And we use the federal share that we earn on that And it goes to pay for our contract and our work to get that prior authorization and utilization review work accomplished. We have a smaller dollar amount. It's a similar situation for the Minnesota Senior Health Options small program, again, where we typically have the federal administrative reimbursement coming to the department to pay for the activity. What happened last year, it was a staff error. We just omitted having those riders in the budget bill. And after lots of conversations with MMB this summer, we determined that we don't have any other way to operate with that authority to retain the federal share. So for the current biennium, the department is basically, because these are high priority activities for us, we've basically found other non-personnel savings, and we've shifted over, and we're using that money to fund these activities so that we are continuing to do the prior authorization, utilization review, and MNCHO. This budget page is requesting funds. It shows on the page as a funding request for the TAILS. It would essentially be the request is to restore those riders in the next year's biennial budget so that we go back to the way it's been in the past years. So it's a very technical issue, but I wanted to make sure that you were aware of it.
Thank you.
Okay, and then Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as far as the governor's unallotment part of the budget, what you have back on the next to last blue section, the section that says department-wide proposals, there is a very short, not particularly descriptive budget page, page number 3. And it's just summarizing that the governor's recommendation in this area is to ratify the unallotments from last summer for fiscal 10 and 11. And then there are some of those unallotments he's also recommending be continued into fiscal 12 and 13. The one-page handout, what I did with that is I kind of sorted the unallotments in the human services area into four major groupings. And the first, at the top of the page, and this is a one-page handout. It doesn't have a page number on it. I apologize. But at the top of the page, you can see there are 13 unallotments where the governor's recommendation is to extend the same unallotment into the 12 and 13 biennium, and you can see the values there. These are, I guess I'll just read the titles. There was an unallotment that eliminated two small chemical dependency grants, and there's also an allotment that capped CD treatment payment rates at 160% of average. There was an unallotment of $5 million out of the state-operated services. There was an unallotment in county grants for child support enforcement and a reduction in the county block grant, the CCSA block grant, it's called, to counties. There were unallotments to eliminate emergency GA and emergency MSA, make reductions in the supplemental rates for group residential housing. Another unallotment to be recommended as being extended is in the PCA area, extending that the eliminating the funding for hours over 275 a month. There was an unallotment that suspended nursing facility rebasing, and the recommendation is to continue that out into 12 and 13, so it pushes nursing facility rebasing out into fiscal 14. There were some ratable reductions in the healthcare area for non-primary care and basic care, and a proposal to, it's called aligning asset limits. It was reducing asset limits for non-disabled families to be the same level that that are in effect for elderly and disabled folks. And then there's also an unallotment of DHS central agency operating administrative funding. And all of those are being recommended to be continued into the 12 and 13 biennium. There were
Representative Abler.
But just to that, I figured that sentence was coming. So that's part of the budget proposal to continue those reductions, but there's not pages for those. That's just continuing that on. That's like a one-sentence
proposal. That's correct,
okay,
Mr. Chair. That's the way that the governor's budget recommendation came out. It was a succinct sentence. There were a few unallotments at DHS that were one-time in nature, and so those are not being continued. Some of those, it's pretty evident that it was taking one-time balances, and so there's no funding left to take. There are a few. I wanted to draw your attention to the third category, which is titled Alternative Supplemental Budget Recommendations. There are some areas. Most of them are in the continuing care part of DHS activities. There's also one in MA where there was an unallotment, and instead what you've heard today is an alternative, basically, in a budget proposal. So these particular unallotments are not being continued because instead there's a different budget proposal before you in the supplemental budget. And then the last category, there are a few kind of unique situations. There was an unallotment that eliminated funding for outreach incentives, and there was savings associated with that because without the outreach payments being made, then there were going to be fewer eligible folks onto MA. Mr. Hoffman reports that at this point he can no longer separately identify anything going on in the forecast that could be related to that. So in essence, that the programmatic impacts from that unallotment are done and accounted for, and there's no additional then savings that could be had. There were a few other unallotments where there basically were one-time reductions where there's a repayment under statute, and those have already been accounted for in the November forecast. And that's the group that includes shifting payments for the continuing care grants by a month. There was an unallotment that increased that managed care withhold by another 1.5%, and that also was a one-time reduction that has been accounted for in the forecast. So you can see those. The very last one is the unallotment that the court has said. No, for the current fiscal year. So part of the governor's budget recommendation is to put that elimination in effect starting with fiscal year 11 and then making that permanent. So there's also a spreadsheet that has tracking detail on that, but I wanted to make sure that you had this list.
Any questions for Ms. Rankin? With none being so, Representative Abler moves the minutes for February 18th.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So all those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved.
No nays.
But we technically still have a quorum.
We could do a lot of business.
Yeah.
Okay. Pass the budget.
Thank you for everybody coming for our late evening meeting. We were able to go through the budget, and now we'll take testimony tomorrow. The meeting is adjourned.